last week we talked about what is a healthy family. And several of the points I made were that the important thing about a healthy family, what we have been seeing about family systems, is the relationship between this father and this mother. If you think of the family as a mobile, as a balanced system, that is what a family is. That's what we've come to understand a family to be, an organism, a balanced system. Then the relationship between these two people, this is the chief component in the dyad, because the balance between these two people will affect the balance between these three people. These are the children down here. So the most important part of the family is that this woman has a good relationship to herself. She respects herself. She has self-worth. She has security. She has a sense of being in a process of completing herself. This man has a sense of self-worth and completion. Now, I mentioned to you that the process of intimacy between two people is a long process, 20 years maybe. So it's a process. And families are not happy and healthy like postcards or Christmas cards. Mom, dad, three dogs, two kids at the fireplace that we send out at Christmas time. That's probably not realistic. The Brady Bunch, Ozzie and Harriet, it's probably not realistic. There's probably a little bloodiness, or what I showed you last week is that these 300 couples that in the study had gone through several stages to get to completeness, but they're in the process of it, and they know they need to work on it. You see, anybody listening to this series, if you want to be open to it, are already in recovery if you think you've got problems, because the first step in recovery is awareness. To know that there's parts of me that are dysfunctional, and to get out of the illusion and the denial. Now, I told you that in the first program. The crisis of the family today is the crisis of denial, illusion, delusion, the delusional systems that got set up when we were little kids about our anger and our rage and our sadness and our hurt that have never been acted out or have never really been worked out. So what we do is we cover them up. Next week, when I do the compulsive family, I'll show you how every compulsivity is a way to manage feelings. So the issue we're looking at is truth, getting to the truth. Discipline, I talked about. Problem in families, good families are disciplinarians. Sick families, dysfunctional families will be unself-disciplined disciplinarians. That is, there'll be plenty of discipline. Kids will get whacked and screamed at and pinched and humiliated and told what to do, but the mom and daddy are not modeling what they're saying. They're not modeling delaying gratification. They're not modeling telling the truth at any cost. They're not modeling self-responsibility and taking care of themselves. They're both trying to get from each other in a dysfunctional family. Remember we said in a functional family, the more complete these two people are, the better they can have intimacy. Intimacy is two people standing side by side looking out. It's dancing, two people dancing, each knowing their part but being totally whole. It's two people playing music together, one playing the violin, one playing the piano, but they're playing the same tune. And so the children then don't always have to please these people because they're already in a process of completion. The children can be valued for the very ones they are. They can be taken seriously. Their emotions can be, their emotional needs can have a soil to grow in. The powers to know, love, feel, choose, imagine, create. They have the right to be different. The rules are you can be different in this family. You can express feelings in this family. You can talk in this family. You can talk directly to somebody in this family. You don't have to triangulate to talk to people in this family. Parents don't say, do as I say. Do as I say, not as I do. The children actually see the patterns, the parents modeling what they're saying. So they're saying what they're doing. And so you don't need any pedagogy. It's not permissiveness or authoritarianism. That any time we're teaching a pedagogy, we're off base. Because we're telling people how to play an act. We're telling people how to act rather than be functional and spontaneous. Remember, we said functionality is what works. When a human being is functional, they work. What works? Their feelings work. Their mind works. They can express their thoughts. They can express their feelings. They have these seven freedoms we talked about. They see what they see, and they can say what they see. They don't have to pretend like they don't see what's going on in the family. I used to teach high school, and I had this real disruptive kid in my class. I'd never look over at him. It just was a lot more comfortable if I didn't have to. He'd be drilling a hole in the wall or something. God, it was great if I didn't have to look at him. The second I have to look at that kid, then I have to deal with it. So one of the things we're going to really see in dysfunctional families is denial. The systems are going to be built around denial. And don't talk about it, don't look at it, sweep it under the table. Now, by the way, tonight again, I want to have some questions. So if a question occurs to you while I'm talking, write it down. And then at about midpoint, you can pass them over and pass them up, and I'll try to deal with 7 or 8 minutes of your questions by the end of the program. But functionality means that I can say what I think, I can say what I feel, I can say what I want. My body is my body, my space. People don't just think I'm a little doll that they can come pick up anytime they want to. My space is a sacred space because of my human dignity and my godlikeness. And my parents are that way too. And the more they respect me, the more I respect them. You see, remember that old thing that was in the dentist's office or the doctor's? If you treat children with respect, they learn to be respectful. And they learn to treat themselves with respect. If you treat them nurturing, they learn to be nurturing. And they learn to treat themselves with nurturing. So what we want to do now is look at what is a dysfunctional family. If you remember the things I said last week, it's obviously going to be the opposite of that. That in a dysfunctional family, like we saw in all systems, the chief component will be disruptive because mama will not have a good relationship with herself and daddy will not have a good relationship with himself. That is, in some way, these two people in the marital dyad, in their marriage, will both be incomplete in a radical kind of way. That is, they won't be in the process of completing themselves. They may be even unaware of how incomplete they are. One of the things that I see as the ultimate kind of issue in the soul murder I've been talking about is that people believe that happiness is outside of them. And that next week when I talk about compulsivity, and then in the seventh program when I talk about the most common family illness, which is the addiction to people, what we're going to talk about is the belief that I need somebody to make me happy, that I need a person to make me happy, that I can't be happy unless I'm with this person. Now, it is true that love is the fulfillment in a real sense of a person's life, but one of the differences between a relationship, two people standing side by side, looking out, sharing life together, which was what I call intimacy, and sort of the other polarity of intimacy is solitude or detachment, as opposed to what we're going to see tonight, enmeshment, two people who can't get apart. And what's going to characterize bad relationships, or somebody's called them entrapments or entanglements, is that you can't get out, or you don't think you can get out. You're stuck. You're addicted to the relationship. There's a symbiosis that's been set up so that the law of necessity rules the relationship. And so people may try to go away. They may break up 87 times, and they always come back together. Or sometimes couples have been in this terrible place in their marriage for years and years and years and years, and that they're symbiotically bound to each other because somehow they're living out of scarcity. And you see, when I live out of scarcity, when I come to you, I am trying to get something from you. When I'm living out of being in the process of completion and I come to you, I don't need to get anything from you. I have the possibility of generously being there for you if I choose to. So a dysfunctional relationship means you don't have two fully functional people. When they come together to relate to each other, each one is coming a kind of a half person that makes one whole person. Now, I told you in the first program
that we have a crisis going on that is a crisis of even what we call normal. I constantly hear men introduce their wife as their better half. It's Southern. That's a Southern introduction. But I want you to meet my better half over here. Now, first of all, I'm real clear the guy doesn't really think that's his better half. Big chauvinistic, you know, darn good and well, he doesn't really think that's his better half. But that's the way he introduces her. And you see, lots of you are working through sex roles, but on our normal sex roles, basically, you have two half people. See, women are intuitive and men are rational. Women are nurturing, men are not supposed to be nurturing. Women are emotional, men are not supposed to be emotional. So it just works perfectly. We just fit like a glove. He uses your emotions, you use his rationality. See, that's crazy. That's two half people. And lots of you have heard me do that one half times one half equals one fourth. And by the way, I know of nothing more accurate that as the years go on, as these two people stay in this kind of incomplete place, angry at each other because the other one isn't making them happy. And in terms of what I talked about last week of the four stages, the romantic stage, the power struggle stage, the owning your projection stage, when people really begin to realize nobody can make me happy and I can't project my femininity on this woman, she can't project her masculinity on me, that I have to own my own femininity, she has to own her own masculinity if we're going to be whole people. You see, in terms of that, a dysfunctional marriage never gets out of the power struggle. It's the constant, well, why can't you ever, you never, you always, can't you ever? And what you hear is just almost like mantras of gimme, 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 gimme. You're supposed to be making me happy. You're supposed to be making me happy. And the other one's doing it too. So two people who come into this then get married, start a relationship, and then guess what happens when the kids come along? How could either one of these people possibly give to their children? Because they're already full of rage and feeling complete and feeling adequate. And you see, in our culture, I'm going to say this every program if I can think of it, any 15-year-old can be a parent without any training whatsoever. You need more training to answer the phone in an answering service than you do to be a parent. And I don't want to put that down as a profession, but you don't have to know nothing to be a parent. To take on what is probably the most awesome job that anyone ever took on in their life, and what is probably the most important job for this society, for we as a people, for the world, of any possible thing I can think of, is to be a parent, and how you're going to teach these people and prepare a soil of people making so that the world can be a loving place. Well, if this woman hates herself or is full of shame or is split in some adapted child role, some mask, some performance, and this man is the same, when these children come along, then this system is going to be highly dysfunctional because of this dyad. Now, I just want to take a couple of minutes and show you something, and I do this at some risk. My friend Wes Seeliger drew me these, and then they were copied by the station a long time ago when I was doing a lot of work in transactional analysis. And transactional analysis was a psychology developed by Eric Byrne. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with this. I just want to use it. If you think of, this is a man right here. This is a man, and here's his head. And in his head is this Victrola with 25,000 hours of tapes. That's what is called his parent ego state. That is, that somehow we've incorporated 25,000 hours from our childhood. You may have heard me quote Ronald Lang when he said, we're all in a post-hypnotic trance induced in early infancy. And I want you to hear this point, because later on, when I talk about sexual abuse and some of those things, it's going to be important to understand how you can carry your parents' feelings and how you may be carrying your parents' behavior, how you may be acting out, extending your parent, doing what they never got to do in their life, and that you don't even know for sure whether you want to do that.
but that's what you're doing? I had a client one time in a law firm, and he threw up every morning going to work. Guy wanted to be a veterinarian. Had always wanted to be a veterinarian. But he had gotten caught up in the family system and real heavy parent tapes, and of course there was a big bonus every year, and got strapped into the money, etc. Then the adult part is the little IBM computer. It just computes, and then here's the little kid. Now remember the first night I showed you that thing, how this private self, how this child gets lost very early on? Well, that was one of the ways that Eric Byrne tried to show the child. He said, look, all three parts of you are there. This is 25,000 hours, and when you're in that part of you, you are literally repeating what your parents did. That is, when you're in this parent part of you, you are them. You are them. For example, how many people really know whether they're carrying their own sexuality or you're carrying your parents' sexuality? Your own parenting styles or your parents' parenting styles? How, you know, I tell the story about getting married and having been a bachelor. I studied to be a priest for 10 years. Been a bachelor for 5 years, clean my apartment regularly 4 times a year. Within 2 weeks, I was chasing her around, furious because of the state of the house. There was dust and sugar bowls weren't filled. And I can remember once as a bachelor making a sandwich with 4 guys like this laying on the counter. Roaches, you know, just my friends that lived with me. You see, that's the parent tapes come on. And that's the same thing that comes on when you get into child rearing. How the heck do you know how to child rear? You didn't have any training for it. No one's had any training for it. We just carry it. And I'm going to suggest to you, we often carry it like a disease. Diseased attitudes, pathogenic parental attitudes get carried from generation to generation. Then here's the computer part. This is like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. This is the part of you that tries to update the parent tapes. That's what this series is an updating of the parent tapes. But I want to warn you right now that there's a child in every one of you, and that's who I'm trying to talk to. That little child in you has been in denial about what happened to a lot of you for a long, long time. So there's a lot of discomfort when we begin to talk about the past. There's a lot of discomfort if we talk about the way we were parented, like we're being dishonorable. Because see, one of the parent tapes is honor your father and mother. What I suggest to you is that when you really honor your father and mother, you'll show anger. Because that's what a real human being does. Vegetables don't show any anger. So do you honor your parents by being a vegetable? Or do you honor your parents by being an alive human being who shows your feelings? Your spontaneity, your vitality. That's what functionality is. It's vitality. It's being alive. Not being dead so you're all repressed. See, in dysfunctional families, all the feelings start getting repressed. You can't show anger. You know how you stop anger? Remember I told you last week, anger is an energy. Boom, boom, boom. The heart starts beating fast. The muscles tense. Because your needs are being violated. So how do you stop the anger? By tensing other muscles. That's how we get uptight. Then next week when we talk about putting something in our mouth, like alcohol or banana cream pie or something, we can then take away the tight gut where we've repressed all the feelings. So this adult part is an attempt to update this little guy, gal, right here. Now, this is the child. This is the spontaneous, vital little person who in the beginning of life, more than anything in the world, needs a mirror in order to get a sense of identity. This child needs a mirror to look in a mirror and say, am I there? Last week, remember, I talked about healthy narcissism. Narcissus looked in the lake and he saw his own reflection. Children need healthy narcissism. That's a healthy part of growth, that you look in there and you see yourself. You see yourself when you're in your little blue suit. You see yourself with little pink ribbons. You see yourself when you go to the potty. You see yourself when you find your genitalia. You see yourself when you're in your instinctual drives. You're all there in the mirror. See, I wonder how many of us were all there in the mirror. Or all of a sudden, oh, there went part of me. I wasn't there when I went to the potty. I wasn't there when I found my genitalia. I wasn't there when I was acting too loud. I wasn't there when I was laughing and snorting, because real ladies aren't supposed to do that. So you got split. You started a process. This little kid started a process of getting split. And the first way this little kid got split is this. This is called the ventriloquist dummy. Eric Byrne once called this part of the child. Now, this is a part of the child in you. That it's like a ventriloquist. To sit up straight, you're going to be humpbacked. So the obedient child following out good pedagogy. See, because here's what good pedagogy is in our culture. Discipline is total control over the child. Parents are to be obeyed because they are the parents. Do what they say no matter what. The fourth commandment demands this type of obedience. It doesn't really. But that's the way it's been interpreted. That what it means is you just march like a little soldier. A child is well disciplined when they are considerate, unselfish, meaning they bow to your selfish needs. You see, every human being is selfish, selfish. That is, every human being lives according to self-preservation. Every human being tries to get its own needs met. The best, healthiest families are where everybody's getting their needs met. The sickest families are where nobody's getting their needs met. Or only daddy's getting his needs met, or only mama's getting their needs met, but the kids don't get any of their needs met. They have to adapt to please the parents. Now remember that little chart? It was that little bitty private self and that public self. And that public self is the adapted child. That public self gets bigger and bigger and bigger as life goes on. As you become, now that's the little professor part of the child. The child is very intuitive. Child figures out real quick, these are sick people. I better please them. Or a lot of kids figure out, I'm going to have to take care of them. I mean, here comes little Sammy Fang Slicer down the, out into life, and he looks around and goes, oh, my God, look what I got. In all fairness, what happened to this mom and daddy is exactly what I'm talking about here. They got split before they had little Sammy. So the sins of the fathers go to the third and the fourth generation. What this series is about is to try to get people to understand that if we don't face it, if we quit staying in our delusional systems, acting like none of this happened, none of what? This denial, repression, constraint, be obedient, well-disciplined, be little robots, march upstairs when daddy snaps his fingers, agreeable, meek, speak when spoken to, are seen but not heard, total conformist to their parents' wishes. What you're preparing is Jonestown. What you're preparing are robots, not creative people who do new things, who are willing to risk and try something unfamiliar. Hey, in all of Judeo-Christian West, God has been the creator. If we were going to make people in the image of God, because a lot of this has come out of our Judeo-Christian tradition that obedience is the great jewel in the crown of glory. I think creativity is the great jewel in the crown of glory. But what really has made this world something great is not obedience. That made Dachau and Auschwitz. What has made life something magnificent is creativity and people being willing to take risks and try something they never tried before. So what we want, look, we want these little robots. They are repressed, no anger. They cry only as long as it does not threaten us. What about vitality, spontaneity, sensuality? Isn't that what life is about? You see the problem? So this little professor figures out very early on, I better adapt to those big giants. Now that's the free child. That's the kid that really gets lost. That's the one that loves to put spaghetti all over it. That loves to roll in the sand or go to the beach or belly laugh.
belly laugh till you just hit the deck. Don't you love to hear a little kid laugh?
And then later on, about 20 years later, you go,
Our little kids cry right from the abdomen. Boy, they just sob, and their little tummies just sob. We go, see, just Mickey Mouse crying. I try to get people I work with to cry, man. A lady called me one night, and they had lost their child about 3 months before, and the father had hardly done any mourning, and he had been crying for 4 hours. And I said, tell me what he looks like. She said, well, his stomach is vibrant. I said, good! It almost terrified her. But that man was getting it out of his gut. He was crying from his abdomen. I mean, he was really letting that energy out. That's what vitalization functionality means, that you can cry like that. So this free child part of us is the part that got locked up a long, long time ago. Now, I want to show you something. In a dysfunctional family, mom and dad come in. Mom weighs 120 pounds. Dad weighs 180 pounds. And the part of them that is alive is this adapted child in each one of them, this mask, this script. So they've been adapting to survive. And I'm going to show you in a minute in dysfunctional families the roles that people get into. We get in lots of different roles. But you can't be yourself. You've got to please them. As a child, I came from an alcoholic family. I knew 50 yards from my house, uh-oh, wait a minute, what feeling do I not have? I began to be able to size it up, and I knew that I couldn't be me. There was a way I needed to survive, because you see, also, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was gone. He went out of the system, threw it all off balance. So each one of us had to adapt to try to make that system balance. There was no way it could stay in balance as long as he was dysfunctional and he was drinking. So I learned very early on that here's my dad over here. He's an 180-pound five-year-old. He didn't just have me. He was 18 when he had my sister, 19 when he had me, but he was about 5 years old emotionally. And if you think of these three ego states, and that each one of our parents are already dysfunctional, you got a 180-pound five-year-old and a 120-pound five-year-old raising a 45-pound three-year-old. Now think about it and imagine what has happened to some of us. And that it's a miracle you're sitting here right now. When you come out of that, now again, if these two people had been allowed to develop that spontaneous free child part of them, they wouldn't have had to adapt to please and then repress all their emotion. You see, because when you're in a role, you can't have any emotion. You just simply can't have any emotion. Or you can only have the emotions that the family system calls for. For example, if you're in a violent family, are you going to show any anger? You got a father, 6'4" father that knocks everybody around? You think any kid in that family, until they get in their teens at least, is going to stand up to that father? It's too terrifying. Every person in that family will repress their anger. Or a screaming, rageaholic father, mother. So one person in that system will be very dysfunctional, and everybody in that dysfunctional system then will begin to try to adapt to balance the system. Remember I said every biological organism tries to go to wholeness and balance. So families try to get to balance. Now, I talked just briefly about it, but say it again. Let's say this marriage is getting real bad. One of these kids may decide to get real sick. I had an anorexic girl one time that her mother used to beat her. Her mother was a violent and a rageaholic. And her mother would beat her so badly that the child could hardly walk. So the child started starving herself. And as she got tinier and tinier, the mother couldn't beat her anymore. And then they'd hospitalize her. When they'd hospitalize her, this man and this woman would start communicating. You remember that principle of homeostasis I talked about? That you see, one person in the system will try to balance the system. Now, a woman named Sharon Wegsnyder worked out some very interesting stuff for us in terms of understanding dysfunctional families. She did this originally with alcoholism, but what I want to show you is that it's going to work wherever you have some dysfunctionality in a family. Let's say you've got one person who is the controlling, dependent person. Could be an alcoholic. It could be a rageaholic. It could be a fearaholic. It could be a hypochondriac. It could be some overeating disorders. It could be somebody in a system. The mother or the daddy is depressed. But this controlling person is full of anxiety and fear. Their feelings have never been allowed to be expressed. Yet their public self is anger, aggression, grandiosity. Any of you who have a question now, pass it over. Your questions to the front. Rigidity. And this person literally in their dysfunction will control this whole system. Whatever they're doing, the system will try to adapt to balance the family. So it's very important to understand that you'll have this dyadic dysfunction, or it may be the dyadic dysfunction. One of the kids will act out to try to balance this family system. But one of the things that we know in dysfunctional families is that there's going to be control. Somebody's going to be, it'll be mother's hypochondriasis. Mother's sick all the time and worried all the time. And everybody walks on eggs around her as she controls the family system. Or daddy's sexually abusing one of the kids. And one of the most important things I can tell you right now, we'll tell it to you over and over again, that the data seems to be emerging quite clearly that there are no secrets in families. That everybody knows. Or let's say this man and this woman are not making it, so this woman starts having an affair. She triangulates. She triangulates to try to balance this relationship. She's not getting what she wants. She's not getting anything from him. So she goes out and tries to get something from somebody else. Love and affection. And a lot of sexuality, by the way. I'll be talking about this next week. But a lot of sexuality is actually affectionalized. It's sexualized, but what the person really wants is to be held, to be close, to be intimate with somebody. It's not the genital act that's the issue as much as it may be just the affectional needs that are not being met. And person doesn't know how to get those needs met any other way. So this controlling, dependent, rigid person creates stress in the system, distress. My father, I can remember laying there at night as a kid wondering whether he'd come home every Saturday night. It would start about noon on Saturday. He'd only work a half a day. If he wasn't there by 12:30, the stomach would start knotting up a little bit. By 1:30, by 2, by 3, I'd be in denial. Oh, maybe he got delayed, da-da-da-da. But, you know, by 5 o'clock, you begin to know daddy's out drinking. And then I remember laying in bed 2 in the morning, just stiff as a board, terrified, wondering what was going to happen. And so you see the stress that's being put on the family. Now, this controlling person, in order for the family to stay in balance, will have to have an enabler. For example, if mama's a hypochondriac, daddy may be the enabler. He'll say, now you kids don't talk, your mother's in her room right now. Now let's all be careful. Don't tell mother. Don't tell mother the bad news. See, an old mama just gets to be a hypochondriac, never hears any bad news for about 40 years this way. It's a pretty good deal if you can pull it off. Or daddy's an alcoholic, and he said, don't talk about your father does drink a lot, but he works very hard. And he really loves you, and he's not an alcoholic, just a heavy drinker. We don't know why your father gurgles and snorts every once in a while when he comes home. No, he doesn't snort cocaine. He would never do a thing like that. This enabler can be a man or a woman. Some of the kids can get into. I'm an enabler. I got into enabling. What the enabler does is in the public self, the private self is fearful and angry, but the public self will be trying to patch things up, take care of the drunk, call the office for him, lie for him, make excuses for him, make excuses for mother, tell the kids their daddy really loves them. He's doing everything for you. That's why he works so hard. And you see a whole lie, this whole delusional system gets going here. And then the kids, okay? So you've got mama balancing the system now by being the enabler. It could be daddy or it could be one of the kids. Then here this kid is often called the lost child, but the good one. A better word for this may be even the good child.
And you'll hear the parents say, well, thank God for Susie. Thank God for our Susie. She gives us no trouble at all. She goes to her room. She does her homework every night. God has blessed me with Susie, and I don't know what I'd do without her. And see, what Susie's doing for the family is she's being so good, she just does it. She's trying to take some of the tension away from the family. But of course, does Susie ever get to be herself? This poor child can never be herself. She's too busy being Pollyanna. She will never have worked out any of the anger she has, that she's been thrust into this position of being good or making straight A's or whatever. She never really gets to be herself. And she'll go to a room and just not give anybody trouble, withdraw. And so she has lost herself too. She's adapting to survive. She's super independent, sometimes overweight, quietness, withdrawal. I'm just giving you a real fast outline of this. The data is that we can almost predict what the person's body is going to look like in 20 years out of these roles. They are so rigid. Do you understand? That's the issue, that nobody gets to be themselves in a dysfunctional family. Everybody is adapting to the threat to try to keep the system in balance, homeostasis, self-preservation. See, the family is an organism, and it has needs. It has needs. Let me show you another need the family has. Let's say mama is a hypochondriac. So daddy doesn't have any wife there. She's sick. She can't ever make love. She has a chronic headache. She has a chronic backache. She never feels good. Okay? So he doesn't have a wife. What happens to this system if it doesn't have a wife in it anymore? What does the system need? Needs a wife. Well, wait a minute. Here's little Susie. Daddy will turn to little Susie and make her his princess. And little Susie will become daddy's emotional wife. And this will happen in system after system that's dysfunctional. And little Susie then will become his princess, and she'll think, how could I be so lucky that I have this daddy that loves me so much? But don't you believe it, because she's being used by daddy. And one day he'll abandon her. He may abandon her when she hits puberty and he starts having some sexual feelings toward her. He may abandon her after she quits being a little girl, because this guy's got a self system that doesn't like women anyway. Doesn't like grown-up women. He likes dolls. He likes little cute things that can't talk back. Okay? So little princess is really getting sucked in. She's getting sucked into an inappropriately bonding, and she thinks she's the luckiest girl in the world. She's not. Then let me tell you what happens. The rest of her life, two things are going to dominate her unless she gets onto this. Unless she gets back to this child in her, to this original pain stuff, because at some level she knows she's being used. For example, this child would have to repress all of her sexuality, with her daddy taking her out and shopping. Sometimes I'll even hear women say, I've started dating again. And I'll say, well, when did you date? It's like their father was their first date. This girl will find people who will use her and abandon her for the rest of her life until she gets onto this. She'll be this princess who keeps finding men. I see some of you smiling. Some princesses are smiling. But, it's sad, too. I'm telling you. If you're not onto this, you will live out the rest of your life carrying that family system with you in those 25,000 hours of parent tapes. Or a boy, my daddy was gone. He was an alcoholic. My mother was working, trying to take care of the family. Of course I moved into the position of being the husband, I was like a daddy to my brother. And that inappropriate bonding will mess you up sexually, your own sexual identity. Part of my going to the monastery was not to break my inappropriate bonding. Now, this is not a blame game when you hear me saying that. I'm not saying my mother knew anything about that. What I want you to hear is that these systemic rules function and have their own power, whether you like it or not. And they take us all with them. And we need to know about them, or else you'll get caught in those systems. You could still be carrying them right this minute.
You could still be acting out your family system right this minute. Because you see, that family as an organism has needs. So this kid helps the family by taking the pressure off. Now here's the scapegoat. This kid feels hurt, probably feels more hurt than anybody in the family. This is the kid who'll start smoking dope. This is the kid that'll become anorexic. This is the kid that'll act out and really jangle up this system. Boy, this kid'll go wanging away and get that system all confused. But what it'll do is it'll bring mother and daddy and the kids together. And it's like the old Jewish law where the priest at the atonement took the scapegoat and smeared the blood, and the scapegoat went out into the desert and carried all the sins. Now, here's the tragedy. Kids have been going to psychiatrists for years as the identified patients who are actually scapegoating their families, carrying all the conflict and disorder in their families, and going into treatment. And as I've told you in previous programs, that's how we got onto this idea that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that this kid is the most hurt of all. This kid needs to be loved and told that they're okay. When we work with these drug kids in Los Angeles and FDAP in Houston, oh my God, are they beautiful when they begin to get through their shame and realize that they're lovable and that they really are okay. And then finally, if there's a fifth person, one of the people in the family will become a hero, make straight A's, be captain of the football team, president of the sodality, and this person will give the family dignity. And they'll say, well, our daughter is going to, our son won a scholarship to Buchloop, or he's the captain of the football, he's an all-state football player, or our son's going to be a priest. See, I was an alcoholic at 13. And by the time I was 20, when I went to Canada to be a priest, I had been the scapegoat. Now I was going to be the hero. Because to a good Catholic family, for a boy to go be a priest, that's being a hero. And from my own intra-system, it was a way out. It was a way out of a lot of hurt and pain. But it's also a way to put a Roman collar on and have a new identity and be somebody who was a hero. Let me have the questions. Okay? So the family, if you're a family hero, you're very successful. You're a high achiever, but you probably don't have any feelings about it. What I found in my life is that I kept being successful. I was valedictorian, and I did this, and I did that, and they'd say, wonderful, you did this. And I'd say, oh, yeah, and felt nothing. Because it's a role you're playing to keep the family together. And you see, the family hero has got to finally start living for himself or herself. And then finally, there's usually, if there are enough kids, one of them will be the mascot, super cute. He's little Susie, and she is so cute, and we dress her up in little dolls, and everybody thinks she's so adorable. And anything to attract attention, she clowns around. Funny, funny little kid will give the family a bunch of laughs and kind of take the heat off the family. Now, I'm thinking of a family right now. I remember knowing this kid when he was little. First thing anyone would say when they come to the family, they'd say, where is Rodo? I'm just making up a name. They'd say, this is a human name. They'd say, what has he done now? And everybody would just wait to hear the latest caper. This kid, the last time I heard, at 39, was living under a bridge. He's still being funny. Goes into pool halls, makes everybody laugh. But his life is just tragic. You see, he's still being loyal to his family. One of the things we know is that you will stay loyal to these systems. So it's an incredible thing to realize that here I am, and a whole lot of my life that I thought was free and that I was making a decision about may not be my life at all. And you see, until we go back into that original situation where that little child, that little free child got lost, we may not know who we are. We may be an act, a performance. What I got in my life at 40 years old is that I'd been a performance all my life. I'd been a helper. I'd been an achiever. I had come, what I heard Terry Kellogg quote somebody saying, I'd become a human doing and not a human being. And everything was doing. Everything was external. Everything was showing off. Everything was to make an impression. My whole life was motivated by people looking at me.
Now, a lot of that had to do with some shame, which I'll talk about next week, because in dysfunctional families, people don't love themselves. You can't come from a dysfunctional family because people in the mother and father in a dysfunctional family don't love themselves. How can they teach the kids how to love themselves if the mother and daddy don't love themselves? So shame is another characteristic of dysfunctional families. Boundary problems are characteristic of dysfunctional families. Nothing can go out, nothing can come in. It's much harder to get out of a dysfunctional family than any other family. If your family's functional, they'll let you leave. In fact, we say a healthy family disintegrates in an orderly fashion. And everybody gets to leave. You get to go. Not in a dysfunctional one. They'll be caught. You need to be helping your sister right now. And see, the boundaries are all enmeshed. And I'll show you some more of that in the next 3 weeks, talking about enmeshed boundaries, where everybody is all enmeshed. It's like if I just wiggle my fingers all together, you wouldn't know which finger was which. And I've got some slides I'm going to show you next week or the following week where I'll show you how your own reality, when you're enmeshed, are fused. So you don't have two people who are apart. You have two people who are fused. And when you're fused, you get confused. You don't know who you are. You don't know where you stop and someone else begins. Daddy gets mad, everybody feels it simultaneously. There are no emotional boundaries. There are no physical boundaries. There are no spiritual boundaries. There are no moral boundaries. You don't know who you are. You're not separated. See, the goal of life is to move from environmental support to self-support. All dysfunction is about being dependent in some unusual way. Let me take a look at a couple of questions. How do you keep a single parent family in balance and teach the child control and discipline? Somebody's missing the point. I don't want to teach them control and discipline. What I want to teach them is to be in touch with their feelings. What I want to teach them is to have those seven freedoms, to feel what they feel, to want what they want, to think what they think, to have the power of those feelings, to be a functional person, to develop a sense of critical reflection and inner independence. But to do that, like I say, it's like having a playpen that just keeps getting wider and wider. Now, what are the sides of the playpen? The sides of the playpen are the parent getting his or her needs met. What I would say to a single parent is have a support group. Don't think you can be the father to those children or the mother to those children if you're a father. You need a nurturing community for you so that you don't try to get them to nurture you. What they need is for you to be there for them so that they can feed off of you and see themselves in you and get their needs met. Now, one of their needs is for structure. Remember, we looked at the basic needs. We all need structure. And what the so-called thing that people call discipline, see, discipline means teaching people something. In Latin, discipline means disciplina. It means a teaching. Now, what are we going to teach you about life? How do we teach you to be functional? By providing a soil in which you can get your needs met through the exercise of your powers. Your power to know, your power to perceive, your power to love, your power to want, your power to choose, your power to create, your power to imagine, your power to speak. So a child needs that freedom. And what I want to tell you is it is just not easy to have a child, period. You better be ready. You better be ready, and you better be healthy, because they are something else. It's the hardest thing anyone did in their life. My child-rearing years are over. How can I use this information? For my grandchildren who have not yet been born? Sure. Or use it even for yourself, because you may still be acting out. See, this isn't just for child-rearing. It's for the relationship between the parent and you and the child in you. How do you treat yourself? How do you take care? Can you let you have fun? Can you dance? Can you be spontaneous? Can you love and be affectionate? Is the child in you available to you? What Murray Bowen calls differentiation. To know when to be intellectual over here at work and then come home and be emotional. To be able to be in your feelings and be spontaneous and to have that choice. See, do we want our lives to be a choice or an unconscious accident? And to me, that's the issue. What I do is me, for that I came. I came here to be me. And then when I die, I want it to have been my life, my one and only life. Personally, I don't believe there are a bunch more times around. I think Slitz is right. This is it. You know, live it with gusto. I have a 4-year-old granddaughter whose father has abandoned her. What do I tell her when she cries and says she misses her daddy? What would you tell an adult who was crying? I would be there for them. I would say, I've not been through that experience. I hear that you're sad. I would just be there and mirror for them and let them have their sadness. Let them express their sadness. See, the danger is to try to stop her from being sad. The danger is to tell her all kinds of idealizations about her father, or to tell her dirty things about her father. Just let her have her feelings about her father. See, remember, an emotion is an energy in motion. When you get the energy out, it's out, and it's over with. It doesn't have to be stored in your body. It's the repressing of the emotions that get acted out later on. That's what we don't understand. It's not a kid expressing hatred. That's what they can do well. It's repressing hatred that's the problem. Then that's what gets acted out later on. Okay? There was a question about spare the rod. And I just wanted to comment on that. Just to say a couple words. I'm going to pick this up later on because we're going to talk about physical abuse next week. There's a way in which very few people have had any kind of education about biblical material and understanding what a biblical text means in its context. The Book of Solomon was written, I don't know when, probably 1,000 B.C. We don't know what the state of civilization exactly was then, but evidently some wise man felt it was good to whack kids then. Now, you have to make a distinction in the Bible between inspiration and revelation. Tobias's dog wagged his tail in the Bible. Is that revelation? If it is, what's it about? Okay, so you can't just go, unless you've decided through your own human intellect that that's the way to read the Bible, that you read every text literally, then that's what we call eisegesis. That's reading your own interpretation into the text. Now, I'm going to say more about that later, but I wanted to introduce that at this point. Before we end this program today, I want to read you a couple of things from Alice Miller's book, For Your Own Good. She talks about she says, the general public is still far from realizing that our earliest experiences unfailingly affect society as a whole. The psychoses, drug addiction, criminality are encoded expressions of these early experiences. I do not consider my task to admonish parents to treat their child in ways that are impossible for them. Instead, I see it as my role to convey relevant information in as vivid and an emotional manner as possible in order to contact the child in you. That child that's sitting there in you that was abused long ago or repressed your anger long ago and is still then carrying certain things in ego defense denial. We'll talk about that some more next week. You know, Walt Disney understood that kid better than anyone that's ever lived. When Walt Disney died, Eric Severide wrote about Disney, and this is the child I want to address in you. He said, to the child, this worry world is brand new, gift wrapped every day. There's very little child in an adult, adult in a child, but a lot of child in the adult. By the conventional wisdom, mighty mice, flying elephants, Snow White, happy, grumpy, sneezy, all these are fantasy, escapism from reality. It's a question of whether they're any less real than ICBMs, poisoned air, defoliated forests, scrap iron on the moon. Walt Disney did more for the world than any psychiatrist has ever done. This is the age of fantasy, but we'll never see the likes of Disney again. Now, to me, there is something profound about that. This spontaneous, wonderful little child in you that got lost a long time ago. That's who I'm calling on in this series.